Now, let's see what they got to eat here. Howdy, ma'am. How you doing today?
Hot, and I don't mean the good kind. So what don't you want?
Pardon?
What don't you want?
Oh, well, I think I just...
You know, I've been working here for 44 years. Ain't nobody ever ordered nothing but T-bone steak and a baked potato. Except this one asshole from New York tried to order trout back in 1987. We don't sell no goddamn trout. T-bone steaks. So either you don't want the corn on the cob, or you don't want the green beans. So what don't you want?
I don't want green beans.
I don't want green beans either.
Steaks cooked medium rare.
Can I get my steak cooked
that
just
a... want no question.
All right.
Iced tea for you boys.
Iced tea be great.
Iced tea, yeah. Thank you, ma'am.
Hey, what's happening? I hit on this at the beginning of my return in the last episode. I don't know about the rest of you, but it feels like there's this huge gray cloud that's been hanging over us for the past 6 months, and it's gotten grayer in the last month or so. And I mentioned this in the last episode, so I don't think I need to get into any specifics. And I think you all know what I'm talking about. It's just depressing. The investigations, the hatred, the separation in our country. And I'm not going to break tradition here. I'm not going to get into politics, but you all know me and where I stand as a human being and as a citizen of this country, which I love very much. It's just not where I expected us to be in 2017. I mean, I've been outspoken. I've had a lot of criticisms, but I'm not a hater. You know, I don't hate people. I don't wish ill will on them. Although I might be critical, I might be outspoken, but I wouldn't physically hurt somebody or just go to war with them because I happen to like vanilla ice cream and they like chocolate, or they're a dude that likes other dudes, or vice versa. I don't care, you know, honestly, it doesn't change my life, and I'm not sure why we have such separation here. So I kept looking for comfort in something. You know, my family's comforting, certainly, but a distraction. Something to get my mind off of all of this stuff. You want to know how bad things got for me? I started to miss Paula Deen. That's when I knew I had hit rock bottom. So I cracked open my cookbooks and I started reading them. I dug into my food magazines, started experimenting with new dishes, some new techniques, and I got out of my comfort zone in the kitchen. And then it all kind of clicked for me. I missed this. I missed talking about food. I missed burying myself in the kitchen for no reason. I missed shopping for new ingredients to prepare, new things to talk about. And I guess that's what drove me back here after I retired the show 4 years ago. So here I am.
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
So much has happened. I'm not even sure where I'd even start, so I won't. I'll just pick up and just kind of throw things out when they come to me, I guess. I'll just tell you this. I'm kind of a skinny bastard now, but I still love food. I stopped drinking a couple years ago, but I will taste new things from time to time. I love to brew beer still. The only problem with it is that I have to struggle, really, to finish a goblet of it. The biggest change for me, however, is kids. Michelle and I got married last June, and I have two stepdaughters now. And I cook for our daughters every day. And of all the challenges that I've ever faced in the kitchen, cooking for kids has probably become the largest. And don't get me wrong, they're great eaters. They love fresh fruits and vegetables, lots of healthy things, yogurt, healthy cereals, seaweed and edamame beans with sticky rice, all the things that you would want your kids to enjoy. But this is more about me and what I want, but I can't have. You know, experimenting and getting them to try new things has really proven to be very difficult. And I was kind of kidding myself, thinking that this was going to be easy. And who can blame them? You know, they're kids. When I was a kid, my favorite things were the same things that kids love today. Pasta, pizza, hot dogs, hamburgers, sandwiches, lasagna, maybe the occasional salad. In fact, I think kids are a lot more health conscious now than we ever were when we were their age. Times have certainly changed. You know, the other thing that we have to deal with are allergies, which I thought for a while might have been some made-up thing, that parents were just being too protective of their kids. But it's a real deal. Peanuts is the biggest thing. There was a kid in our 12-year-old's class, and he's allergic to peanuts. And if he so much as gets a whiff of peanut dust, he could go into an episode where his throat closes and suffocates to death. It's that bad. And I don't know where this started. Maybe the GMOs. I mean, they've got 100 different theories. Could be anything. Could be genetics. Could be the environment. Our eldest has an aversion to tomatoes, carrots, and eggs. Now, think about this. You know me. I cook a lot of Italian food and French food. Tomatoes? Excluding tomatoes from the diet is tough. But she really doesn't care. You know, if I do pizza for her, she likes a white pizza with pepperoni. No tomatoes there, and no problem. So you work around those things. But Michelle, she had it really tough. Her dad is an outdoorsman. And I know I mentioned at the end of last episode that I thought my sister-in-law is super cool, and she is so incredibly cool. I kind of feel like this redo that I'm having in life here is kind of a reward. I've got an amazing family, and my in-laws are amazing. Katrina's family, and I'm not going to disparage anybody, but it wasn't that great. It was kind of a bummer a lot of times. And her father died when she was 19, so I never knew this man. But I heard so many great things about him, and I kind of wished I'd had him, you know, in my life, because I grew up without a father, so I didn't have that father figure. Michelle's dad is that man, and he's fun. He takes me fishing. You know, he's a hunter. He's a real kick in the pants. But when she was growing up, if he saw a rabbit in their garden, he'd shoot that son of a bitch, and they'd eat it for dinner. I don't ever remember having to endure the idea of eating the Easter Bunny's relatives when I was 9 years old. That's fucked up. I think the strangest thing that I ever ate with my mom were snails. And I know I've talked about this before. My mother was just infatuated with Graham Kerr, The Galloping Gourmet, this food show back in the 70s, and Julia Child. And any time she'd see these shows, she'd immediately go into French food mode. So one day she hands me a mayonnaise jar, a cleaned out mayonnaise jar, and she says, "Filippo." And she used to call me Filippo. My name is Philip Mark. And she would call me Filippo Marco. It's kind of an Italian thing. She'd say, "Filippo, take this jar and go collect some snails for me." Now, you hand a 10-year-old kid, a 10-year-old boy, a jar and tell him to go snail hunting, he's going batshit. And that's what I did. I went into our garden. I went to our backyard. I collected all the snails that I could. Then I jumped the fence, went into my neighbor's yard, got their snails. And by the time I was done, I think I had about 30 of these things. So I come back with a jar full of snails, and my mom separates them into separate jars, puts a layer of oats along the bottom, caps them with a Scott towel, and wraps a rubber band around them and sticks them in the cupboard in a dark place. And about a week later, she pulls them out. Now, the oats are all gone. It's just, you know, the jars are filled with snails and snail shit. And what happens, I guess, is that these snails eat the oats, and then they crap it out. And what the oats do is they clean out the system. It's the same thing as if you're going to devein a shrimp. You know, you don't want to eat that shitty intestine that's inside of it. And that's what the oats do. So, you know, garden snail shells are very delicate. If you breathe on them too hard, they'll snap. They're not like the farm-raised snails in France where they're robust and heavy, or sea snails, you know. So she pluck these things out, she'd melt some butter, throw in some garlic, and to me, to this day, the smell of butter and garlic is just the gourmet scent, you know. And she'd cook these things up in brown butter and garlic, and I ate them with my mom. Now, for me, at the time, it's like snot in brown butter and garlic, but they firmed up really nice, and they were delicious. But that's the extent of the weird shit that my mother would make me eat, or at least, you know, introduced me to. She didn't make me eat anything. But then she'd turn around and cook a trout in a cast iron skillet with very little oil, with the skin on it, and it just would smell to high heaven. Trout smells weird anyway. We don't serve no goddamn trout.
We don't sell no goddamn trout.
But there are things, when Michelle and I first started dating, I would make things for the girls that I thought they were going to love. I just figured, okay, I'm going to start cooking. But they wouldn't finish them. But they still had the manners enough to tell me it was delicious, but they ate a late lunch. But the jig was up soon enough. I knew I had to start cooking simpler things for these girls. But, you know, a plate of raw vegetables and fruit salad's not going to cut it. I did some really cool stuff I thought for sure they'd love, but I was wrong. Like cacio e pepe. You know what that is? It's basically, it's pasta in butter with pecorino romano on it. You crack black pepper on there, too, if you want. That's kind of the dish, pasta with pepper. And then I'd make this Parmesan cheese bowl. I would take shredded Parmesan cheese on parchment paper. I'd kind of, you know, lay it down in disc, a small layer in a disc shape. And then I'd bake it in the oven till it melted. Then I'd pull out the cheese with a spatula. I'd carefully scoop it out while it was still hot. And I'd put it over a bowl, an upside down bowl, and form the melted cheese over the bowl. I'd let that cool. You pull the bowl off, and what you're left with is a Parmesan cheese bowl. You put the pasta inside of it, and you eat everything. You eat the bowl, you have the cheese with the pasta. It's really good, but not for kids. At least not these kids. So I started playing around with different stuff to figure out what they would like, and there were lots of things that I could get them to eat that I thought for sure maybe they wouldn't like. Like little fingerling potatoes. I sliced them in half, sauteed them in a little bit of olive oil until they were crispy and brown, and then hit them with sea salt and minced fresh rosemary. They love that. To this day, they'll eat the hell out of that. Trader Joe's sells canned artichoke hearts in a brine. And what I'll do with that is I'll just open the can, empty out the brine, take the artichokes out, cut them in half, and I'll saute those in olive oil. And that's it. You don't have to season those because they're already brined. That's another hit. Thomas Keller's mashed potatoes is a huge hit here. They'll eat that. I mean, they love those. My grandmother's meatballs. Pizza. Now, Michelle bought me a baker stone. What this is, it's like it's a clay oven that's, you know, encased in a metal case. You sit it on top of your grill on high heat, and this clay oven gets to like 500 degrees, and you bake the pizza right inside that little oven. And the end result is fantastic. It's a crispy, charred dough. You know, your crust is killer. And you could throw wood in the grill to give it kind of a wood fire flavor. And that's fun. They love that. And again, I make our 12-year-old, she's got the tomato allergy, so I make that pizza, a white pizza. But the greatest thing, the one thing I thought for sure they would not eat, and this is a great story. A couple Christmases ago, we're going to have our family over for Christmas dinner. So I'm thinking traditional, turkey or ham. In fact, I had a nice ham loin that I had been curing. I was going to smoke it and kind of make a table ham. So I'm throwing these ideas out, and they're out to dinner, and Michelle texts me, and she says, I think I know what I want you to do for Christmas dinner. I want you to make duck confit. Now, Michelle, thank God her, you know, upbringing with her father, her stepdad, was so adventurous because he would make them eat all this stuff. So she's kind of an adventurous eater. She loves duck confit. So I'm thinking to myself, if I remember correctly, your mother really doesn't like duck. And she says, exactly. So I laughed and I thought, you know, you ask me to make duck confit for Christmas. I'm in my element. I'll make the hell out of it. So I did, but then I thought about the kids. I go, well, I don't think the kids are going to eat this. For one thing, they don't like fat. We could take the skin off, but it's still duck. Anyway, Christmas comes. I set this stuff out. And the girls devoured it. In fact, our youngest, I think at the time she was 8 years old, she ate two whole legs of duck confit Without the skin, of course. So they surprise me. And I'm so lucky to have them the way they are, with being so adventurous. And, you know, our 12-year-old now is eating bugs. And I don't know if it's a thing that she just wants to shock people. Like Bourdain tells a story when he was a child. He ate a raw oyster right in front of his family and horrified everybody. Maybe it's that. Or maybe she's just breaking through. I know it's a shock factor, though, and I think it's great. If you'll eat bugs, you'll pretty much eat anything. I know, you know, when I was that age, the snails was, that was really pushing it for me. To eat a cricket, I'm not sure I ever would have done that. But then there were things I thought for sure they would love, and they didn't. Anything that involves molecular gastronomy, no way. Too weird, texture's funny, it's not what it looks like. But I can pretty much cut anything into a heart shape or use a cookie cutter shaped like a cat and they'll eat it. So a lot of times it's appearance too. The girls like paninis. So Michelle bought me a panini press, a Cuisinart panini press. So I make paninis a lot. I made our youngest this sandwich that she likes last month. And I thought, you know, I'm going to spruce this dish up a little bit. So I put a sprig of parsley on it. I sit it down in front of her. She looks at it and she goes, "What's that?" I said, "That is haute cuisine." I'm joking, of course, but, you know, it's fancy. I said, "You know the difference between a $5 sandwich and a $10 sandwich? That sprig of parsley." She throws it aside, eats the sandwich. I even went so far as to buy this book. I think it was called Little Cooks or something ridiculous like that. It was full of all these recipes that looked really promising, but it ended up being a shit fest. So I just cook what I cook. And I find things that they like, and I make them again, and hopefully they'll like them a second time. I know they'll come around, and they surprise me sometimes. They'll be leaving to spend time at their father's house, and I'll be busy in the kitchen getting my actual cooking groove on for a meal that, you know, Michelle and I are going to enjoy, and they'll want to taste what I'm making. And suddenly they like it, and they want me to make it for them. So I remember that, and I make it for them, and suddenly they don't like it. But then they do like it. They're fickle, kids are. Michelle says they're selective. To me, it's fickle. And I owe all of you a great apology because for years, I would spew my bullshit to you about how easy it was to expose kids to good food. Just put it in front of them and tell them that's what's for dinner. But it's not that easy, I found. I would tell you guys how kids are changing, how we as adults eat, and how spineless you all were for allowing that to happen. And here I am some nights eating hot dogs and hamburgers. And I'm not being resentful about this. Don't get me wrong. I love hot dogs and hamburgers. But if it's between that and, say, a Portuguese stew or poke or a charcuterie plate or a bowl of pho, beef bourguignon or lobster bisque, you name the dish, I think it's safe to say that the only time you'd see me eating a hot dog or a hamburger would probably be either while I'm on the run somewhere or at a ball game. I would not think to stick a bowl of pho in front of the girls with entrails and tripe and beef tendons and chicken ass. They'd throw up. I know better than that, but maybe someday they will. And it's not going to affect anything if they don't. The key is to keep them eating and to keep them healthy. And in the end, that is really all that matters when you're cooking for kids.
You guys were not allowed to film in the premises.
Okay, we're just doing a story about there was an issue with a customer up there.
No comment, but you're not allowed. You guys are not allowed here. You have to leave the premises.
That's the reaction we got when we tried asking questions about this social media post that has been shared more than 400 times. The post claims a waiter at the St. Mark restaurant in Huntington Beach asked Diana Carrillo, her sister, and two friends for proof of residency when they ordered drinks. Unsure of what they heard, they questioned him and say that he responded, quote, "Yeah, I need to make sure that you're from here before I serve you."
So I can direct you to our senior director of operations.
Is he able to come here and do an interview?
I can reach out to him.
That's what we were told by staff at the restaurant.
Yeah, this is Matt Johnson with Fox 11.
After a phone call, the director of operations released this statement that calls the incident unfortunate. It goes on to say, quote, "We have contacted the guest and plan to donate 10% of this weekend sales to the charity of her choice, Orange County Immigrant Youth United. In no way are the actions of this former employee representative of the St. Mark brand." Locals who visit the restaurant had this to say.
"That's kind of ridiculous. you're serving a drink.
Probably wow. meant to say ID, not residency. Yeah. St. Mark's a great place. We go there all the time.
Yeah. I love St. Mark.
It's a great place.
Great place. We've been there lots of times. Good times. But that's unfortunate.
And the director of operations also told me over the phone that the restaurant has always celebrated being a part of this diverse community that is Huntington Beach, and that employee, that waiter, has been fired. We're live here in Huntington Beach, Matt Johnson, Fox 11 News.
Disgusting, right? Is this something we saw a lot of in the last 8 years? I don't remember ever hearing something like this go down. Suddenly we have hate speech galore. This is not the America I've grown to know. It's like being in the South in the 50s. Horrible. I think we can do better than this. Okay, so I told you that I took alcohol out of my diet. And that wasn't as hard as you might think it was. I mean, it was at first because I didn't know what to do with myself when I didn't have a beer. And after a while, I realized that drinking, for me anyway, was a habit, a daily habit. It was just something that I did. And when I didn't do it, it felt weird. So I'd have a beer or a glass of wine. Felt normal again. And breaking that habit meant finding something to do other than drinking a beer. It's strange. You feel like you're an alcoholic. And maybe to a certain extent, you are, in a way. You depend on it to get you through your day. But then you find something else, and that replaces it. And pretty soon, you don't look twice when you're in the market and you pass the beer and wine aisle. And that's how it went for me. And once I got past that point where it was no longer a habit to have a beer every day, I became enamored with other things. So I want to stay healthy. So I look for healthy things to have. And that's when I discovered kombucha. Kombucha is basically fermented sweet tea. It's got traces of alcohol, maybe less than 0.5%. So it's not something you're ever going to get wasted on. But it's delicious and has a lot of health benefits. The best part of it is that it reminds me a lot of lambic. When I do taste beer now, and I will taste one here or there, but rarely will I ever drink like a full glass of something, I always try to make it Belgian. Because when it came right down to it, what got me interested in craft beer, and especially making it myself, was Belgian beer. It is, to this day, the single greatest flavor to me. No other beer, no other thing tastes remotely close to what that wild yeast in Belgium does to malt water. It's mystical to me, to this day, how that flavor came to be. But getting back to kombucha, it can be a little expensive. I mean, you'll pay $3 to $5 a bottle for kombucha. So I decided to try to make it at home, just to see how easy it was. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. You're going to hear all kinds of stuff about how kombucha has these incredible miracle health benefits. No one of these things has been proven. People say it cures AIDS, cancer, diabetes, boosts your libido, all kinds of crazy shit. None of this has been proven. And I don't drink it for any of those reasons, especially for libido. Not one time in my life have I ever had a boner-inducing cup of tea. I like kombucha because it's refreshing, tastes amazing, reminds me of lambic without making it illegal to drive a car afterwards. Kombucha is produced by basically brewing a batch of sweet tea and then fermenting the tea using a SCOBY, S-C-O-B-Y. That stands for Symbiotic Colony of Bacteria and Yeast. The yeast is really similar to what we use to brew beer, Saccharomyces. And then there's a bacterial component to it. If you want to try to make this, and it's really easy, you'll need a few things to get started, and they're all relatively inexpensive. Most importantly, outside of the obvious, which is some really good tea, is the SCOBY culture. Now, you can find this online pretty much anywhere. I ordered mine from Amazon. And once you make a batch of kombucha, you'll actually grow your own SCOBY culture. So each time you brew, you come out with a new SCOBY to use, which you can either store in leftover kombucha or in white vinegar and start brewing multiple batches with this, or give it to a friend and help them brew their own too. Like teach a friend a homebrew day. So you'll need a glass jar. A large one, large enough to hold at least a gallon of liquid with a wide opening. I am putting links to everything that you need for this on the website in case you want to do this, so you can do all your shopping really easily. MyLifeIsAFoodie.com. You'll also need a bit of cheesecloth to cover the jar. okay? A little bit of cheesecloth, which you're going to kind of secure with a rubber band. So start by brewing half gallon of tea. For your first batch, make it small, half gallon of tea, any flavor you like to drink. My first batch, I used pomegranate hibiscus, which was really good, really delicious. Then I went to lemon ginger. I shopped around, found all kinds of berry teas. Honestly, you can find pretty much any combination these days, and then add to it with fruit juices and stuff to make your own. So you'll want 8 cups of filtered water and bring that to around 130 degrees, not to a boil, all right? Adding tea to boiling water makes your tea taste really astringent, not nasty, like too much hops. You know, it's got a horrible taste to it. So no higher than 130 degrees. Sweeten this with half a cup of sugar. Stir it until the sugar is dissolved, and then add 8 tea bags or 8 tablespoons of loose leaf tea. If you want to sweeten this further, feel free to add more sugar. Remember, this is going to have a tang to it when it's done, so don't be shy with sugar. Steep it overnight. The longer your tea brews, the stronger it's going to be. Don't rush this. At least 6 hours. I normally do 12 hours or more. Now we'll pour the cooled brewed tea into your glass container. Add 1 cup of distilled white vinegar. Then add the SCOBY culture. Cover the container with the cheesecloth. Secure it with a large rubber band across the top. Put it in a dark place where it can be undisturbed for at least 2 weeks, up to a month. Now the temperature in the room should be no cooler than 68 degrees, no warmer than 85 degrees. Too cool, it won't ferment as quickly. Too warm, and you risk real big bacteria problems. The longer the kombucha ferments, the less sweet and more vinegary it's going to taste. Kombucha should be, it takes anywhere from 7 to 14 days to achieve that level of acidity that you want. The pH in the kombucha needs to be less than 4 or mold's going to grow, and that's why we add vinegar. At around the 10-day mark, your kombucha will form a layer of SCOBY of its own along the top. What this looks like is basically a layer of white fat. And that's a strong indicator that your kombucha's starting to become ready. I usually wait until that layer across the top is about 1/4 inch. That's when I know I've hit it. I usually let my kombucha ferment 14 days or longer. The longer it ferments, the tangier it's going to get and starts to taste more and more like lambic. You can drain the contents of the container into any vessel that you want to serve it from, but I kind of like the idea of individual bottles. Feels more like, you know, a craft beer. So what you'll want to do if you want to bottle it, add 1 teaspoon of corn sugar to each 22-ounce glass bottle, or if you want to add fresh fruit juice, you can do that too. Pour the kombucha into the bottles, cap them, and allow the bottles to sit at room temperature for anywhere from 5 to 10 days before you put them in the refrigerator. Now this is where it becomes more like brewing beer. Okay, if the bottles are stored someplace warm, the kombucha is going to carbonate more quickly. If it's 80 plus degrees where they're sitting, you'll want to put those bottles in the fridge after 5 days, or you're going to have glass grenades in your future and maybe even a divorce. If it's super cool where they're being stored, like less than 65 degrees, they can probably sit for 2 weeks to a month, maybe longer, without any kind of problem. Just do this trial and error. For your first batch, let them sit for a week. Take one bottle, put it in the fridge, get it cool, crack it, try it. If the carbonation is just right, put the rest of the bottles in the fridge. If it's flat, leave them out for another week, try another one. It's trial and error from that point. Or you may not want them carbonated. Just bottle them and drink, no problem, whatever you like. You can also, you know, keg it. If you want to force carbonate, do that too. And from here, you can play with flavors. If you want to bottle them with fruit flavoring, add a little extra, go nuts. You can bottle with fruit juice, like I said, instead of sugar. Play around with flavorings that way too. This is just an example of how to make a simple kombucha. It's easy as hell, fun, really rewarding. And listen, if you do end up pitching a log cabin in your pants from drinking a bottle of this stuff, well, then you're welcome. Glad I could help.
Meanwhile, in California, a restaurant is getting some bad publicity after someone posted a picture of a receipt online. A woman got a discount after she saw a rat run over her foot while eating in the restaurant. And this is how it showed up on the receipt. Take a look. That's right. It says... That's completely real. It says, seen rat. Also, she saw a rat and they only took $30 off a $100 tab. I mean, Even the rat was like, what, I'm not even worth a full refund. But my bigger question here is, why does she even have a receipt? Who stays and finishes their meal after seeing a rat run across their foot? It's so weird. You're like, this is the most disgusting place I've ever been to. Can I see the dessert menu? Have a look at the receipt again, right? What I can't believe is it's typed out, so that means they have a cash register code for seeing a rat. How often does this happen? And they're like, right, so that's $37.75 minus $7 because you saw a rat. And another $5 off because you've eaten a pube.
See? And you thought Ratatouille was made up. That rat was probably cooking her meal for all she knows. No wonder she stayed. The food was probably delicious. Chef Remy, still one of my favorites. Okay, one more thing, then I'll let you guys get on with your day. I saw the movie The Founder recently. It's on Blu-ray now, and if you're interested in the story of how Ray Kroc completely swindled his way into franchising the original McDonald's hamburger stand in San Bernardino into this multi-billion dollar business, I suggest you see it. Here's a clip where Kroc meets the McDonald's brothers, and here's their story of how they got started.
This is the most remarkable restaurant I've seen in all my years in the food service industry, and I've seen it all. I want to hear your story.
We were young and hungry. There wasn't a job to be had in all of New Hampshire, so we decided to pack our bags and head west to Hollywood. I wanted to be in the movie business, and Dick, well, he wanted to be employed. So we landed jobs at Columbia Pictures driving trucks.
Huh.
And after a few years, we had enough saved to buy our own little piece of show business, a beautiful little movie theater in Glendora, which would have been swell, except for the timing. It was September of 29. One minute we're screening The Gold Diggers of Broadway, and the next it's Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
I couldn't.
Nobody in town was making any money except for one fella, Wiley Reed, had a hot dog and root beer stand. Hey, people still gotta eat, right? So we decided to open up our own little stand, hot dogs and orange juice, in Arcadia. And it went okay. I mean, we weren't going gangbusters. There just weren't enough people in Arcadia. Meanwhile, one town over is San Bernardino, and we want to relocate, but we've got no money for a new stand. And that's when my brother here comes up with one of his brilliant ideas. Tell him, Dick.
Well,
he says, why don't we move the stand we've got? Put it on a truck. A genius, right? Only there's one little problem. On the road between the two towns, there's an overpass, and the building won't clear. Now, I figure that's it. We're done for. But then Dick says, why don't we saw the building in half?
Saw it in half.
Come on. So we've moved the restaurant, we're setting up shop, but now we want to do a few tweaks because now it's 1940 and drive-ins are all the rage. I mean, they are the hottest thing going, and I say, Dick, we got to get in on this. And Dick says,
okay.
And 2 months later, we open for business, McDonald's Famous Barbecue. 27 item menu, uniformed waitresses, bring your food right to the car, and it goes gangbusters. We're going great guns. But then sales start to level off.
The drive-in model, as we learn, has a few built-in problems.
Tell me about it.
I mean, for starters, there's the customer issue. Drive-ins tend to attract, shall we say, a less than desirable clientele.
Teenagers.
Hot rodders and hooligans. Juvenile delinquents in blue jeans. And then there's the service. It takes forever and a day for your food to arrive, and when it finally does,
it's usually wrong.
Yeah. The car hops are too busy dodging gropes to remember that you wanted strawberry phosphate, not cherry.
Well, that's if they remember it at all.
And then there's the expenses, the huge payroll due to the large staff required, dishes constantly getting broken or stolen.
Tremendous overhead.
So one day Dick has a realization. He sees that the bulk of our sales are in only three items: hamburgers, french fries, soft drinks.
87%.
So we say to ourselves, let's focus on what sells, and that's exactly what we do. Brisket gone, tamales gone, but we don't stop there. We look at everything. What else don't we need?
Turns out quite a lot.
Car hops.
Walk up to a window, get your food yourself.
Dishes?
All paper packaging, disposable.
Cigarette machines, jukeboxes.
Drive out the riffraff.
Creating a family-friendly environment here.
But that's not enough.
All right.
See, our whole lives, we'd piggybacked off other people's ideas. We wanted something that wasn't just different. It had to be better. It needed to be ours. And that's what brings us to the biggest cut of all.
Which was?
The wait.
Orders ready in 30 seconds, not 30 minutes.
Mecca.
We look at each other one night.
You thinking what I'm thinking?
We're going to have to tear down, rebuild, rethink the whole dang thing.
We're talking about shutting down a thriving business for months.
People are going to think we're crazy.
We were crazy.
If you don't know the full story, I can't suggest this movie enough. It's fascinating. And it's incredibly sad. It's really sad. The ending's sad. If you're familiar with the story, it'll really make you hate Kroc even more. He was a snake. A real cocksucker. A Kroc sucker, actually. These guys had a dream of building a family-friendly hamburger restaurant, the first true fast food establishment, and prided themselves on quality. Kroc came in, pure capitalism, streamlines things even further, takes shortcuts, ruins the integrity of what McDonald's stood for and what made it great, disregards a contract, just sneaky. It's a really well-acted, great story. Honestly, anybody who is interested in how McDonald's came to be would be interested in seeing this. Okay, then. I think my job here is done for this week. Thanks for joining me. Don't forget to visit the website, mylifeasafoodie.com, for links to all the stuff I mentioned for kombucha making. Clips, courtesy of the Weinstein Company, Film 44, and CBS. Music in this episode from Chromatics and Volbeat. If you like the music, use the links provided on the site to buy the songs and support the artists. Until next time, my name is Phil, and this has been My Life as a Foodie. Ciao.
Well, my mama told me, son, you better watch out. All those nasty women are gonna rip you down for down. But I got my pocket full of real tears. I'm a broken guitar mode. Guitar mode. And the story keeps on going. From a sad man told. Yeah! My mama's bad boys dance. I got a whip of fear with a bad boy. I'm a sad man boy. Take a Johnny Cash while I go. I got my pocket full of the retails. I'm not booking guitar mode. Guitar mode. And the story keep on rolling. All from a sad
sell no goddamn trout.